Today, we're hearing the latest installment in our series, The World of the Play, where we look at some of the issues behind the productions taking place at Everyman Theater. Today, we're looking at the play Under the Skin, which is currently at Everyman until February the 21st. The play tackles family dynamics and the psychology of giving part of yourself away. And we mean that the play does in a literal sense. In this installment of The World of the Play, we ask the questions, what does it mean to be a donor or a recipient of an organ? And would you give part of yourself for a family member or even a stranger? We wrestle with all of that and more in this edition of The World of the Play, which we're calling Boundaries of the Body, Limits of Love. Let me introduce our guests. Dr. Rolf Barth is down there, and he's Associate Professor of Surgery at the University of Maryland School of Medicine, Director of Liver Transplantation at UMMC, and focuses on kidney, pancreas, and liver transplants and minimally invasive surgery for living kidney donation, which we want to talk about a bit, and performed the first scarless surgery, which I want to explore as well. And next to him is Joe Funk, who is the living donor social worker specializing in kidney and liver donation and independent living donor advocate at the University of Maryland Medical Center. And next to her is Litza Williams, who is a social worker and director of community services for the Living Legacy Foundation of Maryland. And as Jay Herzog, who's sitting next to me, said, they just were named one of the best places to work in Maryland, which we'll explore why, given the work they do. And Jay Herzog is next to us. If you've seen shows here at Everyman, which you have, which is why you're here, and seen the brilliant lighting design we see, it's because of Jay Herzog, who's the resident lighting designer here, saw his 50th production, his one-year anniversary for liver donation, right?
Liver
donation. Thank you. All coming at the same time. And his physician was none other than...
If I could just take one moment, because I don't get to do this often. Dr. Barth, who held both my living donor's liver partial and gave it to me. Thank you very much for a beautiful gift.
The play itself really focused around kind of the angst of donation, of organ donation. And we had a long talk about that back here. I'd like to begin here about this whole idea of the kind of stress it puts on people or not, going through asking, going through waiting, going through saying, should I?
Well, we, in my role, and I think probably that Joe and Dr. Barth may have more insight into some of this, we work on the deceased donation side of the picture. And so...
We don't have much to say about it once it's done.
Well, right. And we do hope everyone signs up and makes that decision in advance. But it's a very different decision to make a decision about giving a gift after versus when one is still alive. But what we see for recipients is they know how long that waiting list is. And as the play references, that it can be years waiting for a deceased donor simply because the demand far exceeds the supply when it comes to organ donation. So that does bring up the question of how does one ask? Who does one ask? When does one ask? And I think a lot of those challenging dynamics, and we hear that from recipients. I sit on the board of a group of individuals who are on the wait list and who have received, and we hear that many times from people of what an internal struggle that was. And Joe, I know, does the social work with many of those individuals who are waiting, who are thinking about asking, and probably sees that even more than I do in a more deep way.
Joe, why don't you pick up?
I work with the living donors, not the recipients. We keep our teams are very separate, so we can be objective. So many people come in to want to be an organ donor, and part of my job is to check and see, are they under pressure, coercion? You know, this is a great thing to be doing, but it is not for everyone for a number of reasons, and it's not something that you can put a price on, that you can get paid for. It's something that you need to think through many things, not just the medical, but how does it affect your relationship with the recipient, with the family members, et cetera, et cetera. And people should not feel guilty if they choose to opt out or not proceed with all the jumping through the hoops of the medical piece to get there.
I think in my role with the kidney donation specifically is to talk to people once they've been screened by Joe and members of our team who are then coming into our clinic to be evaluated as a potential candidate. And I think Joe said that the separation is extremely important, that there's no crossing of agendas. And it's not only something that we kind of feel committed to ethically, but really are legally and regulatorily bound to abide by this, by the Medicare, by all regulatory agencies for organ donation. And so when we evaluate the potential donors, that decision is very much separate from the whole reason they're there, which is to donate someone they care about or they want to feel that they want to donate an organ. But as soon as we start evaluating them, we don't take any of that into account. We just look at them as a person who is being considered for a medical procedure. So when I meet them as a surgeon, it's a very awkward meeting because, you know, I tell them that every other patient I've met that week or that month or that decade is kind of a decision about surgery, is a decision about risks and benefits. And surgery is, in terms of medical procedures, oftentimes carries the highest risks during that period of surgical operating. But the benefits oftentimes and are the whole motivation and justification to do it. So I, you know, as a surgeon, we like to be very simple. If it makes your life longer and it makes your life better, then we can justify doing an operation. And then we talk about living donors. And then suddenly that question is, does it make your life longer? No. Does it make your life? And I, again, as Joe does, I always ask the donors when I start talking to them to just put everything, all their motivations aside and be selfish for just a few minutes with me. Does it make their personal life better, their own health? And so when we get very selfish and specific, donating an organ does not accomplish either of those goals. We then, of course, come full circle and talk about how wonderful it is. And of course, it's not only makes their life better, it's one of the most important and wonderful things people do. But when you get really to the most personal, physical aspects of having an operation that you don't need and doesn't really accomplish anything to your own physical being, it's a high burden, and we really take it extremely seriously. And I think, as Joe said, you know, we don't want to do this on people who it's not right for medically or socially. And these are tough decisions, and it's, again, it's a lot of, I think, a thought goes into this.
Yeah, that, I mean, that's the part I really want to kind of explore in some greater depth. And Jay, just why don't you jump in, just your own kind of reflections on that since you went through this.
Well, has everybody here seen the play? No, okay, so we're not giving anything away. We'll be careful about that because the play really needs to be experienced without that. It was difficult for me to even, I mean, I knew through talking to Dr. Barth and other doctors on the team that my donor had a risk. You know, there was a real risk to it.
What do you mean?
That they, like any surgery, they're not guaranteed that they're going to live through that surgery. They can't. And they're very, very honest with it. I heard it almost every meeting that I had of what the risks are. And I had also gone to a couple of conferences where I heard from one of the other doctors on the team. And it's hard to ask somebody is the other part of that. You know, it's really hard to take somebody that you might love and care for because that probably that person who's going to give that gift to you does to think about whether or not it's something that is right for you as a recipient as well, not just the donor. It was a very, very, probably the most emotional thing I certainly have ever had to do in my lifetime. It's not something I would ever want to have to do again, that's for sure.
And I think that this is the part of it, because there's some connections here that I was thinking about what you all were saying a moment ago about there are some people for whom this is just not right. Now, what does that mean? Why would it not be right?
As living donor advocate, I hear a number of things. Some is people feel like they're so young, they have their whole life ahead of them. What if they would have children at some point who need a kidney? Or, you know, they're so young, what about their future health? Or sometimes I am concerned about emotional maturity. Like, do they really comprehend how big this is? And if the outcomes, you know, don't benefit them, that type of thing. Sometimes right reason, or I should say wrong reason, would be doing it to look good in the family, doing it to redeem themselves, doing it to bring peace in the family. I mean, they need to think about them and take care of themselves first.
Are there medical reasons why somebody might not be a good donor recipient?
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of medical reasons. And we, you know, start out when we, as physicians, kind of start the discussion about organ transplantations, it's with recipients. And when we start talking to recipients, we encourage them to think about organ donation from a friend or family member or living donor. I mean, the basic numbers to get to the kind of the harder, cold clinical facts are 100,000 plus people waiting for kidneys, and we only do 18,000 kidney transplants a year. So that's not great, because 82,000 people are still on the list or may not survive that year for kidneys. For liver transplants, it's even worse. You know, of all the people waiting for liver transplants in the U.S., by the end of that year, half of those people will have died. So there aren't things like dialysis to support their lives. So as physicians, as people interested in promoting organ donation, I mean, we're kind of always against this really life or death kind of disease. And one of the most amazing things are the resources that family members, loved ones, friends, and sometimes people who don't even know these people feel compelled to try to help people who are extremely desperate. And the solutions, you know, oftentimes are living donors. Now, medical reasons, your question on medical reasons for living donors, many. And there's a whole battery of sophisticated tests. There are some actual benefits to organ donation that people sometimes talk about, and not to be too lighthearted about it, but we say, you know, for the donor who's getting evaluated, they kind of get the million-dollar executive physical because they really go through the ringer. They get extremely sophisticated x-ray scans looking at their insides. They get evaluated with all sorts of tests, trying to predict to the best of our ability their susceptibility to future medical conditions. And any of those things that are brought up that potentially may be an issue for them in their health can exclude them. And then there's just anatomic, looking at the organs. Are those organs the ones that will work correctly? And then there's scientific and immunologic. Do they match? Are they a good match? What are the chances of rejection? So lots and lots of hurdles. So that path is a long one with lots of different points that even very motivated people don't always get through. And that can be depressing as well, too, to want to donate and then be ruled out for other reasons.
Taking a step back here about the not the living donor, but the ones who are going to give them up after they pass away. I mean, how many of you, I mean, I have that on my driver's license. Mm-hmm. When I first signed up for that, I remember we used to make light of it as a joke, you know, like, wait, just take what you need and wrap me up in a burlap bag and throw me in the ground, I'm fine. But what does that really mean? I mean, because obviously clearly there's some real issues here for people about donating organs and tissues once somebody they love has passed, once they've passed.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we know that many, many people support organ donation. And one of the things that you just mentioned was that from a living donor perspective, there can be guilt if someone wants to be worked up to become a donor and then they realize there's a health reason that prevents them. One of the things many people don't realize is the reason there's such an organ shortage in this country is because though there's this huge net of people who sign up at the DMV or the MVA to become donors, medically, to pass away in such a way that would allow someone to help others as an organ donor is such a rare event. And I think it's something that people underestimate. So the perception is that the need for donation is low. I mean, the need is low, that not a lot of people need transplants, and millions of people are signed up as organ donors. So what's going on here? But in order to be an organ donor when you pass, you have to die in a very specific way. You have to be on a ventilator, in a hospital, in a very controlled environment so that your organs are still going to be healthy enough to be able to help someone else and not have a condition that would rule you out for donation. So one of the reasons we do a lot of education around this is because, to give an example, Maryland had a record-breaking year of organ donors this past year. And anybody want to care to guess how many organ donors we had in Maryland? It was around 150 organ donors in the state of Maryland, which is wonderful that we had a record-breaking year. Many people, including I do education with new residents and physicians in the hospital, I asked that question and I asked, do you think we had 5,000 donors, 500 donors, 50? You know, I asked all the different numbers. Many of them think 5,000 donors in the state of Maryland. So even within the medical community, people often aren't aware of how rare of an event this is. So we really like to do this education and let people know and make sure that they've thought it through. We hope that most people recognize exactly as you described that once you go, you're not going to need them anymore. Hopefully you're going to check that box at the MVA, have that heart on your license. But we know that there are other issues that come up for people where they struggle with the decision. And we know that sometimes families are really disappointed at the time that their loved one dies, knowing that they had signed up to be an organ donor and then they weren't physically able to do that, because most people physically are not able to do that. So what we want everyone to remember is, I mean, donation is about the decision. It's not about the outcome. Most of us, when we die, are not going to be lucky enough to be able to have our organs save somebody else's life. But that decision is what gives hope to all the people who are on the list waiting. What gives hope is that they know people are signing up anyway. They're saying yes. And hopefully year after year, we're going to have more people becoming organ donors. And then we'll have supplementing that more and more living donors, we hope, as the years go on, to try to get the wait list down.
So that 150 number were people who were deceased.
Deceased organ donors, right. In the state of Maryland. And then we had an additional 400 tissue donors in the state of Maryland as well, which is also an incredibly important gift people can give.
The difference between organs and tissues and what you look for in donors.
Well, I can say the difference between organ and tissues, and then maybe you can say what you look for in donors. In terms of organs, it's the things I think many of us think of. So it's our heart, our lungs, our liver, our kidneys, our pancreas, very rarely our intestines are able to be donated as well. But when we're talking about tissues, we're talking about things like our corneas and heart valves, skin grafts, bone grafts. And those things, actually, the net is a little bit wider because someone doesn't have to be on a ventilator to be able to donate those things. It's still a rare event to be able to donate those things, but it's a little less rare than it is with organ donation. And so in terms of those things, I think we, when we evaluate people for organ and tissue donation, we have some broad things that we look for. And then the surgeons more specifically, so we can say generally, this looks like someone who we think may be a candidate for organ donation or for tissue donation. But the surgeons then really go a little more specifically. One thing I think surprises a lot of people is the things that don't rule you out for organ donation. You can have hepatitis C and be an organ donor. You can have a history of IV drug use and be an organ donor. And a number of those things people assume would rule them out for donation. And at the same time, there's a lot of really specific things that they are looking for that you have to meet to be a donor, be it deceased or living, which Dr. Barth can probably say more on.
Yeah, I mean, these are decisions that when our team considers round the clock. I've got phone calls at 11 p.m. and at 3 a.m. and at 5 a.m. last night with different scenarios and different donors. So we really, our job, again, is the pressure we feel by two blocks away of about 500 people waiting for liver transplants and almost 2,000 people waiting for kidney transplants just two blocks away. For the state, it's about double that. You know, we heard we did 150 organ donors, which is great. But when you have 4,000 people approximately waiting for kidneys and 1,000 waiting for livers, those numbers do not add up. So our job is to try to use as many organs as we can because of the desperate need. One of the things that some patients in the play, for those of you who may see the play, and kind of an interesting concept, I think recipients, and maybe Jay could reflect on this, come to it with different perspectives. Some people are looking at getting fixed, getting a hip replacement, getting a new shoulder, getting a new kidney. And that kind of, they sterilize this as a mechanical device or something that's not a biologic and kind of connected to humanity. So when I talk to people, I always remind them that you're not getting a new kidney or getting a new liver. They're all used. And it's just how gently they're used or not. And so the calls about what rules people out or not, or, you know, they're all used organs, whether it's from a living person or a deceased person. And our job as physicians is to make sure they work. That's kind of an increasing challenge. And there's new medical things all the time that allow us to push those limits of organs that can work and save a life. And again, the wait list. But I'm not sure what Jay's perspective was on what you were looking for in an organ.
Wow, that's a hard one. You know, my friend Mike, by the way, says all the time that his liver now is the youngest person in his family. Because, you know, it's much younger than he was when he needed one. His donor was much younger than he was. What am I looking for? I was looking to survive for my family. I don't know what else to say about that. I needed to go on a little longer. And I remember looking at my wife, who's... Yeah, she's sitting in the back, cowering. I remember looking at her and saying, you know, I'll take 10 years. I'll take to the time when I feel like my children have established themselves and moved forward just enough so I no longer have that feeling of what the role of a parent is. letting them know, me knowing that they're going to be okay, that the family's going to be okay. And where it came from, honestly, I didn't care. We talked quite a bit, actually, before we talking about living donation. We talked quite a bit about high-risk donation. Some hospitals will not put a liver or kidney into you unless it's in prime condition. And others, they'll say, well, this will last you a while. I believe you did, or Dr. Lamantina did one, the 75-year-old woman last year or 2 years ago. There was an article on that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, again, I think Maryland, for both kidney and liver, just again, but we serve the patients of the state, and there's tons of need out there. And if the livers are a little more special than kidneys, livers don't age the same ways. And so people in their 70s, and there's I just reviewed a paper of a series of 80-year-olds who had donated organs, their livers, for transplantation. And kidneys, likewise, even though they age a little bit more connected to every year on the body, advanced age, completely healthy people in their seventh and decade and beyond can have very highly functional organs that can save someone's life.
One of my friends who was also at UMMC had his 31st kidney anniversary today. 31 years. That's amazing. And I know somebody else who's on his 40th. And, you know, often, especially with kidneys, people, oh, there you go.
right in the audience.
You know, people who have multiple, they receive a number of them over their lifetime because the kidney will only last for so long. I can't even imagine what the surgery must have been like 35 years ago.
You're listening to The World of a Play, Boundaries of the Body, Limits of Love. We're talking about the play Under the Skin, which is currently playing at Everyman Theater. We have to take a very short break, but don't go away. When we come back, we'll hear the rest of that conversation. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, right here on The Mark Steiner Show, on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Today we're hearing the latest installment from our series, The World of the Play, where we look at some issues behind the productions at Everyman Theater. Today we're looking at Under the Skin, which is currently at Everyman and is there until February the 21st. We're talking about family dynamics and the psychology of giving away part of yourself. My guests are Dr. Rolf Barth, Associate Professor of Surgery at the University of Maryland School of Medicine and Director of Liver Transplantation at the University of Maryland Medical Center, Jay Herzog, who has been Everyman Theater's resident lighting designer for 20 years and a recipient of a liver, Joe Funk, living donor social worker, and Litza Williams, Director of Community Services for the Living Legacy Foundation of Maryland. Because everybody reads and hears about transplants on some level in the papers and the news, it comes up all the time. But we know really very little about it. And this whole question of how long they last, that you both spoke to and alluded to, how long one can live with a liver transplant, and how do you know that? And what are, you know, and kidney transplants, and think that and the other part of it is the reality about how far medical science has gone in terms of being able to do transplants, making them work, but now the struggle is how many people need them and can't get them. What does the social worker say to people when they're looking for transplants about that reality, and what's the medical reality to go with it?
For living donors, they want to see maybe a parent be there for their child's graduation, for another wedding, or they just want to enjoy that friendship or the parent-child relationship they have. They're not ready to let go of that yet. For some people, it's just the satisfaction of knowing that they've we're helping someone. When people are the non-directed donor who just say, here I am, use my kidney for whoever, just to know they helped the human race is a big thing for them. And just to let them know that, you know, there's no guarantees of how long this will last, but we expect that recipients would take good care of it, take their anti-rejection meds like clockwork the rest of their life, that type of thing.
We, of course, get hung up on the numbers, how many years, how much time. And one of the things that has always really impacted me is sometimes patients don't survive. I mean, when someone gets a transplant, they are very, very sick for different reasons, especially when we look at things like livers and lungs and hearts. And from the donor family perspective, again, on the deceased donation side, that can sometimes be really disappointing to a family if the person only lived 6 months or a year or 2 years. And interestingly, when we've talked to the families of recipients, and some of them have written letters to their donor family even after the recipient has died, and so many of them have said how that time was, I mean, so precious. And how do you really quantify that? How do you really put a number, even if it was only 6 months or only a year? And I think something else that always stuck with me is I had a family who said, you know, had he never gotten to the top of the list, had he never gotten transplanted, we always would have wondered, had he died before he got, I mean, there's 21 people who die every day waiting. Had he been one of those people, we always would have thought, God, if that organ had just come, maybe he would have survived. Now at least we know he had that chance and it just, for whatever reason, didn't work out. So I think there's other layers beyond just the numbers that really are meaningful to recipients and families.
How about medically?
I mean, the medical science is, you know, it may seem slow from externally, but it on the inside, it's kind of a breakneck pace of what's going on and what's possible. I mean, I'm fairly typical for a lot of physicians who get interested in transplantation, get very attracted to the science of immunology and the possibilities of what that could entail. And, you know, I was thinking, I went to my first transplant meeting probably 25 years ago, and what people were talking about then compared to what we can do now, both with new medications, new types of transplants. I give a lecture to the medical students every month on their introduction to surgery and transplantation, and things I was talking about is 4 years ago of what's possible in the future with hand transplants and face transplants and animal organs that may be used for humans. You know, I have to keep on changing my slides because we keep on ticking these things off. That 2 or 3 years ago in Maryland, we did this amazing 36-hour face transplant across town. They've done hand transplants. We're looking at genetically engineered pig organs that get closer and closer to being able to be used for humans. So the scientific, you know, potentials are huge. But a lot of times still, they're disconnected from all of the people who need something now and today. And so that the medical science has tremendous promise for the future, but doesn't really help you if your problem is today. And so today it's much more a functional result of how do we find organs and use more organs for people who need them.
Mm-hmm. So as you were saying that, Jay, I was thinking about when you first realized that you needed a liver transplant. You can tell that story a bit about what happened to you that I've read. That must have been very harrowing on some levels because liver transplants, there could be a long list. You might have had to wait longer than you did. You're kind of very lucky that whatever reason, I'm going to get into that reason why this, you know, why that happened so quickly for you and what the medical reasons are. But talk a bit about that. And that's a very trying time.
It's interesting because I could tell the story two ways. I could tell the story that all of a sudden on Labor Day 2014, I discovered I had liver disease. I could also tell the story that once I knew that and I was able to think back on all the little possible hints that I got actually over the last 30 years was quite interesting because they stopped taking my blood for donation in 1987 because of a elevated liver enzymes. And so I did have doctors that kept an eye on that for me, but all of a sudden it just mattered. And I had no idea other than gaining, they were draining about 25, 30 pounds of liquid out of my body every 2 weeks. And by the time I really couldn't see my feet anymore, I figured out that something was desperately wrong. Actually, it happened the opposite of that. First, I found out that I was desperately wrong, and then they started to do the drains. Then, of course, the first thing that we all do right now is we go to the internet. Oh, that was hard. That was really, really hard. You know, everybody wants to discover as much as they can about their disease. And what I discovered was people who had been waiting 4 years, 5 years, even 6 years for a transplant and how sick they were. The first time I actually walked into Dr. Barth's office, their clinic, I saw people sitting across. My Donna, you remember this as clear as can be. A young man, probably younger than me, and Donna looked at me and says, "So is he 45 or is he 75?" So part of my process also was, what's worse, having your people around you, you know, I'm a teacher, I teach at a university, I didn't want to give it up. At the same time, I didn't want to walk into the classroom with a walker, you know, and have those students care that much about me. I work in the theater, we're very close-knit people. And so what do I put other people through? It wasn't very long. I mean, my donor, who does ask to be media anonymous, my donor went through a slow process of going through the tests. You know, you could get it done in a week. We went through slow process just because they were busy. We took our time with everything. We gave lots of thought to each step along the way. I don't actually think I got a phone call, the final phone call. I was pretty assured, but I think I got the final phone call from the transplant coordinator a month before we actually picked the date for the transplant. It was being in the room with my friends, my family, a donor. The hardest thing that I ever went through, Mark, is I watched the donor goes first. Mm-hmm. So you're in a room with them, and all of a sudden you say goodbye or see you later to the donor. And when it's somebody you care about, no matter what, whoever they are, I mean, they're giving you something like that. The hardest thing I ever had to do is watch them roll that person away. I had not seen Dr. Barth at all that day. He was scrubbing up. You know, I don't remember much. I think the first 3 days post-transplant are kind of a big blur to me. The drugs were great. But it was something totally unexpected, something I never thought would happen to me. I had many, many friends reach out, talk to me, Skype with me, just make my life a lot better, just because I do surround myself with some wonderful, loving people, and they saved my life.
So that's a very important story, a very moving story. And I think that's the complexity of this. I mean, so if you have a donor, person willing to give an organ, then obviously you're at the top of the list for getting an organ transplant. But that donor may not match. So let's talk a bit about that. I mean, and then what it is about some people why they have to wait so long. So what are the issues involved here?
So the paired kidney exchange is our program for if you're not a match with your family member, whoever you want to donate to. There's a computer system through the whole country, United Network of Organ Sharing, that matches you with the best, so that the donor's kidney goes to a stranger who's a good match, and their recipient gets from a stranger who's a good match. Example was someone recently, she was not a match with her family, so her kidney went to Rhode Island. Her family got it from St. Louis the same day. So both donor and recipient have to be willing to look at that. You know, that's a whole other level of, you know, what if I never get a thank you from that stranger, that person? How do I feel about that, given to a total stranger or receiving from a total stranger?
You know, from the medical side, yeah, I was talking to a sixth grade class on Thursday, and it's pretty simple for some organs. For liver, it's just your blood group. If you've got the same blood group, in terms of what people hear about a match, that's all you need. For kidneys and for other organs, we start looking at kind of a little bit more of your immunogenetics and these molecules on your cells called human leukocyte antigens, and we really try to define which people will really be most compatible to on these pairs. But then that becomes, again, a calculation of what they've been exposed to in the past, the recipients, if they have proteins directed against these people, actually tests that mix the blood together to see if we can predict if there's reactions against them. And those are kind of some of the simple things we talk about in terms of matching. But again, I think that the common sense approaches that we now have, that even when people can't be matched, that there are still ways that we can successfully have a living donation pair, at least with kidney transplantation. We don't do that yet in liver transplantation, that someone kind of makes this altruistic swap of that allows both people to get accomplish their goals of getting being a living donor and being a recipient for the person that comes in together.
That's it. Go ahead, please.
I was just going to say, and I think, I mean, maybe this seems obvious, but I think sometimes we have to connect these dots, or when I say it, living donors go, oh, I hadn't really thought of it that way. We're so focused on the person who was waiting, who we know, you know, that individual. But these living donations, when they have them, I mean, they don't just help, you know, it didn't just help Jay. It helped the fact that Jay didn't have to go through the deceased list means that someone else who didn't have a living donor on the deceased list was one person closer to getting that transplant. So when these paired exchanges happen, and sometimes you see them in the media where all of a sudden it was 15 people, you know, all of those make that impact on the deceased donor list, or, you know, tremendously when people are waiting. So it's the individual piece, but it's that global piece too, that it's really helping so everyone else who's waiting too.
Like the domino effect.
Yes. Jay, you're going to say what?
I think it's really the other thing about this was when I first put this out on Facebook, because I did, I don't think anybody that I knew, and I have pretty smart friends, knew that you could donate a living liver. Everybody knows, or many people know about it. I don't want to say everybody. Most people understand kidneys because you see it all the time. I will tell you that until I met my GI, which came before I went to the university, I had no idea that I could actually ask somebody to donate a liver. I was shocked by it. And that's a really, really important piece of news to get out, because it happens. I'm standing here or sitting here because of it. So,
I mean, it's a big deal, and I think what we've tried to focus on, you know, I wear both hats with kidney disease and liver disease. For kidney disease, half of the people who donate are alive; the other half are deceased. The deceased people obviously give two kidneys, but the living people, we only restrict them to one for now. I think that's the best idea. For liver disease. For liver transplants, it's only 2-3% of all of the people getting liver transplants get them from living donors. And it's newer technologies. It's more advanced training. It's training that isn't even obtainable in the United States oftentimes. Our team, everyone has undergone, after a decade of specialty training after medical school, spent extra 6 months or years abroad at other institutions that do hundreds of these a year. United States has lots of reasons. We're a little more risk averse to these big operations, that even though the chance of dying may not be substantially different, but the chance of risks of wound infections or prolonged recoveries are more substantial, that living donor liver transplant hasn't really hit prime time. And so that's kind of, again, something that's really the impetus on us, is to demonstrate reliable, safe track records that can make people feel that not only can this happen, but it's a very tangible thing that, while it does have risks, is overall extremely safe and has proven track records that when we meet people, they feel that not only are we going to be taking care of them, but that we're going to take care of their living donor, and that it's not just we're focused for these kind of selfish goals of the transplant, but really being measured by both goals. Transplant's extremely heavily regulated. You can go online right now on your phone and look up the results at Maryland, at any transplant center in the country. They get updated every 6 months. And so everything we do is watched extremely closely. Sometimes that makes us risk adverse, because we don't want to have too many bad outcomes in diseases that oftentimes are fatal. We try to even minimize by taking less risks. But again, we don't get measured, and they don't report as much on how many people really die waiting.
So were you about to say something, Joe?
I was going to say, people don't give their entire liver. We haven't people, talked
yeah,
about
so
that.
They, exactly. I mean, people give a piece of liver, and the liver is really unique organ in that it grows back. So kidneys don't grow back. You can only you know, you donate one kidney and you have one left. The liver, again, this is what I told the sixth graders, it doesn't make sense in the math problem because you cut a liver in half and you give one half to a person and another half to the other person, and you end up with two livers. So it's kind of a special organ that way.
I want to explore just something you just said about why America seems is behind the curve here in some ways, and why you have to go overseas to really study and learn it. And what is it about our culture, our medical culture, our health insurance culture, whatever that is, that makes us makes it so difficult here? I mean, so and if that wasn't the case, how different would our landscape be?
Well, I think one thing I would say to that is that we have had a culture here in the United States of deceased donation happening, right? So people, you know, we introduced this, it's been slow as people have signed up, but it has happened. And so that allowed us, I think, to develop a really outstanding deceased donation system when it came to livers. And Dr. Barth could speak to this more than I, but I've talked to some of his colleagues about this, that abroad there are countries where deceased donation is not culturally accepted. People are not donating organs after death. So as a result, there was more motivation to develop some of these living liver donation systems within those countries because there were no deceased liver options. And so those kind of training facilities and technologies, I know one of Dr. Barth's colleagues told me the hospital where he trained did more living liver donations in 1 year than the entire United States did in 1 year. And I was staggered by that, you know, by hearing that number. But I think that that is part of it. I think there's also the risk piece that, you know, you mentioned, but I do think that from people who I've spoken with, that is a piece of it, is if you're in a country where deceased donation isn't happening, you're looking for those options within living donation.
Kidney donation in this country is extremely well balanced, obviously, as we just said, but the cultural and kind of the international variability is huge, that the rules about brain death and organ donation, in which some countries, the only way you get a transplant is if you show up to their clinic with people in your family or friends who can donate, and those countries have to excel in living donation for livers because they can't. And then you have a country like Spain, and some of the European countries, but Spain's a good example, which has presumed consent for everyone who, once they die, are presumed that they're going to donate their organs. That myth of that solving the problem, the United States, again, I think LLF, Living Legacy, talks about this a little bit, that we have as high organ donation rates as those countries with presumed consent, with the downside being is that in some of those countries, everyone says, well, there's no need to donate living organs because all the deceased organs are being donated. So they're further behind, again, for kidney donation and such like that. So cultures have very different opinions. There's lots of family dynamics and feelings of obligations and things like that. That, again, this is why transplant teams and the organ recovery, organ procurement groups have social workers to help navigate these things that are extremely complicated.
So, go ahead, Joe.
You mentioned earlier about supply and demand. Nowadays, there are less donors, I mean, less organs available, too, because we have things like shock trauma that saves people's lives where in the past they would have died. We also have people who are choosing to die in hospice, and you need to be in a hospital. So that changes. We have better safety. You know, we all need to wear seatbelts now. So that saves lives, meaning all that, meaning less organs for transplant.
Which is great. It just means less organs.
It's just understanding all that.
Right.
See who wants to speak on here. But I have a thought.
I just have a quick question, which is, as a layperson, you know, I hear discussion, political discussion, with regard to various technologies, say stem cell research or cloning, and I just am curious. You know, what would you say to me? What should I think about in terms of that debate and how it might affect what you all are talking about here in terms of transplants, if at all?
Again, they're highly relevant, and the transplant programs are restricted really to mostly just universities, and of all the hospitals in the state, only two do organ transplants, and those universities are also engaged in a tremendous amount of research. So again, at the medical school down the street, we have in the laboratory not only animal organs that are being genetically engineered to be closer and closer, but we're growing organs in the laboratory that we're taking out all of the cells from whatever animal or potentially person used to have their cells in that organ and seeding them with these new stem cells to potentially... I always say it's kind of like the architectural rules with like historic buildings. You can't rip out the outside, but you can put in all new plumbing and wiring. So stem cells that can kind of seed new organs with healthy tissues. But these are exciting. They're highly promising. They're definitely going to occur someday. They're not going to happen now, and they probably won't happen next year. So, you know, the research, transplant can't occur without any of the science and the research, number one. Number two, transplant can never occur without the donor, whether it's living or deceased. So we're super dependent on external forces. The ability as a doctor to sew two blood vessels together was over 100 years old. They were trying to sew kidneys in dogs in France in the turn of the 20th century. But none of it worked until the drugs were developed. It didn't really happen in this country until we had organized systems of, after people passed away, that they could donate their organs and be allocated through national lists. So the science, again, with stem cells and things like that, very exciting, very promising. I have no doubt that it will become a reality at some point, but it's not something that I would say would affect people on the wait list today.
I have two questions. One is, I'm really curious, what are the countries that have developed this where you all got your training abroad? And the second question is, I had always assumed that somebody who was biologically related, you know, would make to the recipient, would make a better donor, and now I'm questioning that. So can you speak about that, please?
I'll tell you, so for kidney donation, I'm going to put a little plug in for Maryland, but for kidney donation, I think the United States is as advanced as anywhere, leads the world in kidney donation surgery. And in fact, you know, I think Mark said this, we changed techniques about 5 years ago to a technique where we make an incision that's inside the belly button. And when the patient, we're done with their surgery, their donation surgery, we literally, the Band-Aid is too big. We cut the Band-Aid in half just to put it over the little belly button scar. So for kidney donation, we've made significant advances in how minimally invasive we are. Liver donation, because it's not, hasn't gained as much traction in the United States. Turkey and Istanbul is kind of one of the centers that country does not have, again, partly because they do not have a good system of deceased organ donation. They've had to develop high volume living donation, and then Korea likewise, and Japan, because they don't have historically had not had brain death rules, they had to develop living donor liver transplant programs, as well as a large burden of disease with hepatitis B in Southeast Asia. So Turkey and South Korea are probably the epicenters for high volume living donation. The United States, you know, has the technical expertise and such like that, but those countries clearly are a little bit ahead of us.
Yeah, and if I could brag for, I think, University of Maryland and Johns Hopkins in terms of kidney, you know, nationally, I think are really well known here in Maryland for really pushing the limits of seeing what can be transplanted in a healthy way when it comes to kidneys. And when I talk to colleagues around the country and speak at a lot of national things, our centers here in Maryland, I think, are known for being willing to look at and potentially transplant kidneys that otherwise might not have been transplanted elsewhere, that may have been discarded in another place in the country because of some of those restrictions, and really doing the research that it takes to keep pushing forward here in this country. And I think, you know, you're right with kidney donation, but just so everyone knows, here locally in Maryland, I think there's a lot being done to push that forward and to let people know that these kidneys that maybe some people thought couldn't be healthily transplanted really can.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, Baltimore is for kidney living donation and even deceased donation has been probably as important as any city in the United States, and that the first minimally invasive techniques to take out a kidney rather than cutting someone in half and taking out a piece of rib that used to be the way people had to donate kidneys, those were developed here in Baltimore, as well as the use of these really kidneys that people would have traditionally not even considered and could demonstrate just as good outcomes. And so both centers have contributed. the paired kidney exchanges, as well as all these desensitizing programs that allow people who potentially were viewed as incompatible to get new medical therapies that suddenly made them able to accept that. That all happened in Baltimore. So,
and you were one of the, said the program that you performed the first.
Yeah, I mean, we were kind of trying to refine our technique surgically. And, you know, I trained, my transplant training was 15 years ago. And we were doing minimally invasive surgery. But a lot of the things we focus on, no offense to Jay, but we're always so recipient focused on the disease and what we're doing with our patients who are need help, need life-saving cures. But a donation process, you know, is also something that's the donor side. So for somebody who doesn't get anything out of it, how can we do that better, do it more advanced, make refinements that donating a kidney not only allows you to recover and go home the next day or a day and a half, 2 days later, but also leaves you with less physical scars. We have a clinical trial now that's using robotic instrumentation through just one very small incision too. And so again, these are things that potentially benefit the donors in being able to make recoveries. I mean, the donors are amazing people. Joe's testimony to this, they want to donate, they want to do these great things, but then they're also really busy. They're like, okay, I'm going to donate, and then I'd like to go back to work. I've got a ton of stuff to do, and this, you know, where am I going to be? And so for us as physicians to help them donate with as little interruption to a completely physical, full, robust life, but also socially, they've got tons of things going on, too, that they need to kind of take their break to do this.
And at the University of Maryland, I just want to say, I was in a hospital room that looked like a hospital room. My donor had a suite with fruit and vegetables and all kinds of things when people came in. So they're getting it right.
What is the moral issue of the deceased families? Of the family whose son or daughter or mother or father have died and have donated a heart or a kidney, and they want to meet the person who receives it?
Sure.
Litza.
Yeah, I can certainly speak to that. So we've come a long way with all the medical things. We've also come a long way in how those interactions can happen. So when you go back 30 years, there was a lot of focus on keeping things completely distant. There is still anonymity, and we absolutely respect on deceased donation wanting to keep that anonymity if both parties want it. If both parties are open to meeting, we absolutely want to support that happening when both parties are ready. So a donor family and a recipient, either one can initiate communication. So they can write a letter to a recipient to the donor family to the recipient. If they are comfortable, then they can absolutely both share their personal information. They can meet, they can connect, and we see more and more of that year over year. And it is so powerful to be part of some of those meetings. And I think what we hear from donor families so often is that the focus in the media, the focus when we talk about it, is so heavily on the recipients and their lives being saved and that healing. But for so many donor families, I think what they express is in their grief, it is so healing to know that there is someone out there who lives on and exists because of this amazing gift their loved one gave. And to be able to connect with that person is truly healing to them in their grief. So I think it really kind of brings full circle how it all comes together for people.
I want to thank Everyman Theater for partnering with us on our World of the Play series. You can check out Under the Skin at Everyman Theater up until February the 21st. Find tickets at everymantheater.org. We have to take a short break, but don't go away. When we come back, we dig into the Mark Steiner Show archives and listen to my interview with noted environmental author and theorist Frances Moore LePay to talk about her book, EcoMind, Changing the Way We Think to Create the World We Want. Stay with us.